Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to this very special interview where I should be talking about the prehistory of Britain and what the British people are. And I am delighted to be joined by Tom Rousell, a.k.a. Survive the Bloody Drive. How are you, sir?
Very good, thanks, Bo. It's good to be back.
No, it's great to have you back.
Yeah, good to see you.
I love having conversations with you. It's always brilliant. I love to be in the presence of someone whose knowledge is far deeper than mine. So I should be picking your brain here, if anything.
Oh, you know a lot about many things I don't know about. It's not true altogether. But.
So let's kick off. Would you want to talk about just the history of the ancient peoples of these islands?
Sure.
So yeah. A long, long time ago, maybe, you know, talking 900,000, between 800,000 and a million years ago, there was a land bridge with Europe. This is like many ice ages ago. This is when there were sort of primitive mammoths, long, long time ago.
Mm.
So there have been creatures here, whether they were pre-human creatures or not, for that long.
Mm.
However, the story is only really of any proper interest, isn't it, when we get up to, what, something like 13,000 years.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, we have
the first rock art and stuff.
The Mesolithic is a warm period following the Ice Age. And there have been different human beings and also other hominid species living on what's now the island of Britain before, you know, in the Ice Age and before. But we're only the ones that we have any like significant ancestry from to start with is in the Mesolithic, when you get Cheddar Man's people,
right?
The Western hunter-gatherers. And they have left some bits and bobs, like there's some deer frontals you can see in York, like it's like a kind of like the two antlers of a deer that they would wear on top of their heads. And there's the Starcar pendant. It's like a little rock pendant with scratches on it. So they have like, and there's lots of like little microliths, little spear points they use from those times. Mm. Not a lot of art in Britain, but Britain was connected to the mainland still in the Mesolithic, in that warm period.
Right.
And it didn't close off until the end of the Mesolithic, I think like 9,000 years ago.
Right. So not long ago.
Not that long ago.
Of things.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that archaeologists have found basically chips of flint from as long ago as 900,000, even a million years ago, where it's clearly somebody who understood stone working that long ago. However, when you get up to, it's not that long ago that the channel was created. There's a great bit. I mentioned it just the other day. I don't want to sound like a broken record. Somewhere I mentioned it on someone's live stream, but I'll say it again. There's a great bit at the beginning of The History of the English-Speaking Peoples by Churchill, where he says at some point there would have been two inlets, which becomes the channel, at some point long ago. And at some point these two inlets meet up.
Mm.
There would have been a day, almost certainly a day, or at least when two marsh systems connected in some way, and that was the beginning of the channel.
There was some hunter-gatherer knee-deep in the mud hunting some ducks, and then he realised... Yeah. He was in deep trouble. Yeah. The waters came in.
Yeah, or you're used to seeing this small causeway of land between two big bits of land, and at some point it's cut off.
Yeah.
And you
I imagine it was all soggy and muddy long before the two waters met, but it was all wee wetland. Like a lot of Doggerland, which connected Britain to the mainland, it's very low land, so it would be soggy. It would be wetlands with lots of, which is meant hunter-gatherers would go there to hunt ducks and things like that.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, it wouldn't be very, there was no great civilization Atlantis on those muddy, on those muddy swampy bit of land.
I'm holding out hope. No, but it is remarkable, I think, to think of how young the channel is, essentially.
Yeah. And the Ride and the Thames kind of met once upon a time.
Mad.
Yeah.
But there's some. I think some of the oldest rock art is that like there's some caves in Cheswell or somewhere where there's some sort of picture of some sort of glyph of a deer or something.
Oh, really?
And they're looking at about 13,000 years ago, something like that.
That's
so right
Mesolithic.
At the end of the last ice age.
Yeah, that's early Mesolithic. So that would be our ancestors of this Western hunter-gatherer group. There's rock art in France that's much older than that. Some of the oldest in the world. There's also some very old rock art in Southeast Asia. I don't know that much about the rock art in Britain, but the Western hunter-gatherer people, Cheddarman's people, they only account for like a good deal less than 10% of the DNA of modern British people. Right. So not a lot. Maybe 5% even. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's less than 10%. But, for example, myself, my maternal lineage is from Western hunter-gatherers, right. And which is U5, the same as Cheddarman. And my paternal lineage is also from Western hunter-gatherers. So on both sides, I descend from them. So if you even if you had the most exclusive and very high barrier to entry for indigenous status of saying you had to have 20,000-year-old roots. Well, I've got those too, but most of us don't. Yeah, most of us don't.
I really need to get my DNA done at some point. I've kept meaning to do it for like, for like 2 or 3 years now.
Yeah.
And I keep putting it off, but I've got to do it soon. But yeah, so if we move the story on a little bit then, so I suppose maybe, well, where would you want to go from there? The earliest builders of Stonehenge type culture, that sort of culture.
Yeah, well, they're the reason we have any ancestry from the hunter-gatherers in the first place.
Right.
Because when the hunter-gatherers, the hunter-gatherers first met the first farmers, they came to Britain about, they left, the first farmers of Europe left Anatolia 8,000 years ago, and they reached the northern shores of France about 7,000 years ago. So it took them 1,000 years to get all the way across Europe. But it was another 1,000 years before they crossed that little bit of water to get into Britain. So it's about 6,000 years ago they start entering Britain. But we don't know why they were so hesitant to come to Britain. But it's probably something to do with, in my opinion, a hefty population of hunter-gatherers there that made it not suitable for them to go across because there were already too many people there. And I think that in some cases around the world, such as in the Pacific Northwest of America and in parts of Japan, you can see that rich marine resources can support a large hunter-gatherer population that normally you would only associate with a sophisticated society with farming, because you need to be able to provide food and to have a town. But you can get towns, they have like townships in the Pacific Northwest without farming because they have an organized harvesting of oysters or whatever, crabs
Japan
or whatever.
Japan is a good example of that.
Yeah, Japan, the Jomon people.
A big population without agriculture. Because the sea is so rich.
Yeah, they've got so much stuff. They had like pottery and stuff. Pottery is normally associated like in the West with the arrival of agriculture. But there is certainly in Japan pottery long before agriculture.
So what would you call those people or that culture that first came across there? Are they like Yamnaya people? Are they Cordidware people?
No,
what?
They're before those.
You tell me.
Before those. So, okay. Well, the geneticists call this migration the early European farmers, EEF.
That's just what they're called.
From they came from Anatolian hunter-gatherers and crossed the Bosphorus 8,000 years ago. And then they mixed with the indigenous European hunter-gatherers to become this group we call early European farmers, which is why because we descend from them, that's why we have some indigenous DNA too from the preceding people. But archaeologists divide them up into names according to their material culture. So for example, LBK or the TBK linear ceramics in Germany, or the globular amphora culture,
and these are
the same race, but they're different in different regions of Europe. They had different cultures. In Britain and Ireland, some archaeologists might call them the grooved ware pottery people, but they didn't have grooved ware when they moved here. So I like to call them the megalith culture about 7,000 years ago in Brittany, in northwestern France, the people there started making megalithic structures like stone chambered tomb passages and stone circles and all these things that we associate with Britain now. Or when 1,000 years later, when they moved to Britain, they brought all that in, and then to Ireland, they brought it there. That's why the Western early European farmers all across Western Europe are very much associated with this megalith tradition, building megaliths. But in Orkney Islands, when a plague hit around 5,300 years ago, maybe 5,200 years ago, a plague hit Europe, wiped out huge amounts of people. Loads of people from that time have been found to be infected with plague. Like a significant number of the people in the tombs are, I think it's like a quarter or a third. And that's like, I don't know how many died, but it's gonna, that's just one pathogen at the time. So we can imagine a lot of people were dying of, of a plague in that time. But in Orkney, it didn't seem to happen. They didn't get hit for some reason. And as a result, their pottery style, grooved ware, later becomes the default pottery for all Britain and Ireland. Mm. So like even 1,000 years later, people in Britain, Stonehenge, are making, are using this pottery. So that's the, like, it, like the Orcadian pottery is the most fashionable ceramics you can have in the late Stone Age Britain.
For people that might not know, the Orkneys are right at the top of Scotland, the Orkney Isles, right off the very top of Scotland.
Yeah.
So is, I find it endlessly interesting and worthy of note how important Orkney is to our prehistory. Again and again it comes up, oh, this, we see this first in Orkney. This comes from Orkney.
Yeah.
And it happens again and again and again. And the archaeology on Orkney is incredible.
It's amazing. I just, my next video is there. I went there second time.
Oh, really?
Because I went there 14 years ago, made a video, and then I went there this summer again. And my next video will be looking at some of those. I went to Scarabray, the best preserved Neolithic village in probably all Europe, at least Northern Europe. It's fantastic. It's like walking into someone's home from 5,000 years ago.
Briefly, what could possibly explain that? Why right off the very, very north of Scotland? I mean, windswept doesn't even begin to explain it, does it? Like it's remote. It's difficult. Why would it?
It's a really like low islands right in the North Atlantic off the north coast of Scotland. Not great place to live, but it's a really important place for the late Stone Age. Two reasons, I think. One is very simply because there were no trees there, they had to build with stone, which means for us, there's a lot of stuff still there.
Right.
Whereas everyone else would have built wooden houses in most of Europe. They didn't, they couldn't. And so we've got a lot of evidence. We can see what their homes look like. That's one good reason it's important for us today. But why was it important for other people in the rest of Britain at the time? It's because of the plague, because they basically, the plague hit them too, but it seems like about 200-300 years after everyone else. So if you can think of like the complex social networks, like complicated systems and all the like systems of labor required to make monumental structures like, you know, these that megalith builders made, those will start to collapse. And like the period of massive megalith building did start to decline around 5,000 years ago around the rest of Britain. And you also see a massive decline in crops to the extent that wheat and even barley go completely disappear in Scotland, for example, for a time, and in parts of Ireland. So it was a really, really severe impact from plague. It was like, you know, like post-apocalyptic landscape, but not in Orkney. So gradually, after that plague, like Orkney's safety kind of allowed it to play some kind of influential role on the rebuilding of the rest of Britain. Mm. So afterwards, as Britain and Ireland recover from the plague, you can see Orkney is like a sort of a hub of culture, cultural influence. But then as the Wessex culture in around Stonehenge grows, then by that time, the last stage of the Neolithic, at the end of about 4,500 years ago, a period of massive monument building occurs around the Wiltshire Plain, Salisbury Plain, including Stonehenge and Silbury Hill. And by that stage, obviously, this is the centre, not Orkney.
Right. Which is actually very close to where we're sitting right now.
Yeah, it's area where we
are. It's remarkable. Yeah, like the Salisbury Plain and the Wiltshire is truly an ancient landscape. I think I might be completely wrong about this, and I think maybe it's disputed, but I think maybe some of the pig bones or even some of the stones at Stonehenge came from Orkney, as far away, possibly anyway, as Orkney. But
yes.
That's a slight thing. One thing, that's before we go on, if I can just get Dr. Goebbels about it, just briefly, very quickly.
Yeah.
The people from Anatolia that came to Britain, what would they have looked like? Because they wouldn't have looked like modern day Turkish people, because the modern day Turkish people are largely sort of Central Asian or Scythian, the sons of Osman. They've come from Central Asia. That's the modern Turk, right?
Well,
so you tell me, what would they have looked like? They were R1B people, though, weren't they?
No, you're thinking of the next invasion.
Okay.
The next invasion brings R1B.
Okay.
But these people, you're right, they're not the same as the current inhabitants of Turkey, or because the Turkic invasions happened later. Although modern Turks aren't as Turkic as you think they are, they're only about 10% Turkic. Okay. Okay. The rest of them is native Anatolian. So they so they would have had some resemblance to modern Turks, but not the closest living relatives to these people today are Sardinians. So Sardinians are almost entirely this pure Neolithic race who survived today. If you want to see what people in Neolithic Europe look like, probably very close to Sardinians. In fact, very, very similar. They're uniquely unaffected by the Indo-European migrations that happened across the rest of Europe later on at the end of the Neolithic. That didn't really affect Sardinia, and so they preserved that. But yeah,
there's plenty of megaliths on Sardinia, right?
The megalith culture reached Sardinia, yes, but that reached it quite late. Because as I say, the megalith tradition started in Brittany, so it started in the north. But the people, Neolithic people, were already in Sardinia before they adopted that tradition.
Right. But, the oldest megaliths are in Brittany.
The oldest of the megalithic culture of Europe. Yeah. There are other megalith just means big stone, right?
Sure,
so
sure.
There are other monuments made from big stones all over the world, sure. But they're not the same cultural phenomenon.
Right, right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, so when they first came over, because one of your areas of expertise is looking at sort of genetic and DNA evidence and things. So maybe I'm confusing what I'm about to say next with a later wave or something, but the idea that in the genetic record, a lot of the original Neolithic peoples were replaced. I mean, it's not quite like a modern day demographic replacement or anything, but you see the older DNA die out relatively quickly and be replaced by this newer Anatolian DNA.
Yeah, so basically, a really interesting thing happened. So, yes, the hunter-gatherers were, as you can imagine, in recent history, what happens when a people who have farming and large settlements and organized, you know, societies start to encroach on the lands of, you know, fractured, scattered hunter-gatherers. Gradually, they become more and more marginalized. Mm. The hunter-gatherers eventually disappear. Yes, that's what happened. But there is not the same thing as what's happened in any modern recorded example, because the hunter-gatherers all have blue eyes. That's where we get blue eyes from. Those of us who have blue eyes, they come from the Western hunter-gatherers. And but the incoming people, the Anatolians, had lighter skin, and we get lighter skin as a result of them. And the original Anatolian migrants carried haplogroups like G2A and other like Near Eastern haplogroups associated with the Near East today. Right. But the farmers in Britain that we look at all have indigenous male haplogroups, which means that when they moved to Britain, there was an initial period where the women of these farming societies were marrying into the indigenous males, right. Even though like the overall genetic code of the new farming people was from this incoming group almost entirely, their paternal lineages all came from the natives. So the natives had some important role in, and it seems to me likely that what killed the natives was disease and loss of hunting grounds and things, so their way of life. But lots of them were able to marry into the farming society, and that probably they had some status within the farming society, because even in Brittany, when the megalith culture begins, there's evidence that the actual megalith tradition was borrowed from or influenced by the hunter-gatherers that had been there before. So it could be a continuation and an elaboration of an indigenous tradition. Right. And in fact, Stonehenge itself is built over the top of a place where native hunter-gatherers had wooden posts. The post holes are now marked there. If you go to Stonehenge, it shows on the ground these where the wooden posts were. It says Mesolithic post holes. So there was already it was already holy for the hunter-gatherers long before the farmers got there. And there's other sort of evidence to believe, like in Ireland, they've done DNA testing on the elite farmer, you know, the guys in the chamber tombs. Mm-hmm. And they not only carry the indigenous lineages, but also they seem to be more likely to carry phenotypes associated with the indigenous hunter-gatherers. So the elites have slightly darker skin and blue eyes, both things that were associated with the natives. Right. So it might be, they weren't natives, they were so inbred. They were extremely inbred, like these elites were. The average farmers weren't, but they looked at the Irish elites in the tomb and they found some of like like first degree inbreeding had happened, like it's like father daughter kind of inbreeding level, something equivalent of that.
Yeah.
And that usually only happens like in pharaohs or whatever, where they're trying to preserve their bloodlines.
Yeah.
And when we look at their phenotypes, they're preserving the phenotypes of this extinct hunter-gatherer race that used to live there. It looks like they might be inbreeding to try and keep something alive from the old hunter-gatherers among the elites. So
remarkable how often that happened. The Ptolemaic dynasty was terrible for that. And of course, the Habsburg. So one thing I wanted to, you've already said a fair bit on it, but maybe we could just drill down slightly more on it. So this view that you've got these indigenous or native hunter-gatherer type people, and then there's a newer influx of sort of farmers and also maybe metal workers.
A third thing. Yeah, that comes later.
So quite often I think the older view is that they were just replaced like violently or something. But my thinking now, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is exactly why I've got you in here. My latest thing I've read or seen is that it was probably less violent, less like an actual military invasion or something, because there doesn't seem to be large amounts of warfare and things. Just that maybe they came over, they interbreed, and their cultures mix. The indigenous people take on the culture of this megalithic building people. And it's less that they're just coming over like a Viking invasion or a Roman invasion. It's not like that, like the farmers come over and just start butchering hunter-gatherers.
Well, there's not that much evidence like for that. Right. Well, there's not much evidence for that, but it does seem likely that hunter-gatherers generally are going to be less resistant to some of the pathogens that people who are in contact with animals regularly as farmers are going to have, and they would have started to build up an immunity to it. So I'm sure there was violence. There's always violence. You shouldn't...
genocide, though. There's no evidence that they came over and genocided.
No, there's no evidence of that. It's colonization. They're just taking the lands, and there's mixing, obviously. And the mixing is not just on a sort of system where hunter-gatherers are low status and the farmers are the high status. It looks like the reverse is also true sometimes.
That's interesting.
That doesn't happen in recorded history. So in modern times, you never saw, like, there are no like elite lineages in America of Native American descent like controlling the country now. That would have been an equivalent, some sort of roughly equivalent, but it didn't happen.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.